Thank you, Pastor Jones. When I was having a bad time in the hospital, shortly after Pastor Jones became your pastor, he came to visit me. Now, you may not understand this, but you know, did you ever fall in love at first sight? That's what happened when he was there. And as he left the room, I said, "I love you." And that's true. And how thankful we are to have him as our pastor. Three African notables that I wish us to think about. First, the Queen of Sheba. When she was Queen of Ethiopia, Ethiopia extended clear down to what is now Zimbabwe. You've heard of King Solomon's gold mines, haven't you? They're in Zimbabwe. I could spend the whole time telling about what happened when she and her son ruled that vast empire. Beautiful, beautiful empire. Well, she introduced the Hebrew religion to those people. And amongst the 12,000 African tribes, you will find many who have elements of the Hebrew faith in their indigenous life, livelihood, and service. We were sent to minister to the Wanyakyusa, a tribe where there was no churches, no schools. They didn't like Europeans. Very primitive. If I told you all about it, you'd be unhappy. But anyway, they were beautiful people. And the first thing that surprised me was they would not eat pork and they would not use tobacco. Very primitive people, living as their ancestors had for hundreds and hundreds of years. Where did they get that? They got that from the Hebrew faith that permeated that country. And sometime there's some stories about that we'll tell some other time. You've heard of the black Jews, haven't you? Remember when Israel was airlifting black Jews from Ethiopia? There's a black Jew colony in Israel. Okay, you can thank the Queen of Sheba for that. And her son Menelik, who was a great king, emperor. Our second character is the Prime Minister of Ethiopia under Queen Candace, a devout African Hebrew. How do we know? He came to celebrate the Passover. That's how we know. And he was reading the Hebrew scripture. And he was reading Isaiah 53, the very chapter that foretells the crucifixion of Christ. And he wanted to know more about it. And there was Philip at just the right time. And you have the story. But to him, we give credit for the founding of the Coptic Church. And the believers in the Coptic Church for 1500 or 1600 years were all Sabbath keepers, just as we are. Some of them still are. And of course, we have many missionaries there too now. 900 years later, we have a third character, and she's the woman I wish to talk to you about today at Sojourner Truth, a former slave who helped change America and had close formative ties with the Seventh-day Adventist Church. She was an evangelist. The message that she preached is now through our church preached in virtually every nation on earth. I'm indebted to the staff at the James White Memorial Library at Andrews University who helped me compile some of these facts. They were new to me, and they may be new to you. But now let's have the rest of the story about Sojourner Truth. The underfed 11-year-old black girl shivered alone on the auctioneer's platform. "What am I bid? $80? $50? $25? $10? $5? No bids. She's big for her age. She'll make a good worker, have lots of children. Still no bids. Very well," said the auctioneer. "Here's a flock of sheep. They're worth $150. Take her, and you can have both her and the sheep for $100. A man with an English hat raised his finger. The hammer hit the block. Sold with the sheep for $100. A slave girl named Isabella passed to her third owner, a businessman named Neely. Belle, as she was called, had with her parents been the property of a Dutch colonel, Johannes Hardenberg. Hardenberg owned 2 million acres of prime land between the Hudson and Delaware rivers. But he died. So his slaves were transferred to his son Charles. Then he died. 8 of her brothers and sisters had previously been sold. There were no heirs, so Hardenberg's chattel, livestock, and slaves went under the auctioneer's hammer. This skinny, unwanted Dutch-speaking child. Now listen to this. She was later to become a national celebrity, known worldwide as Sojourner Truth, evangelist and lecturer in 22 states. A friend of Presidents Lincoln, Johnson, and Grant, she shared speakers' platforms throughout the nation with such men as William Lloyd Garrison, publisher of the national magazine entitled Liberator, Wendell Phillips, known as abolition's golden trumpet, and George Thompson, noted British abolitionist and a member of the English Parliament. Sojourner was to be the subject of an imposing marble statue ordered by the Pope. It was carved in Rome by the famous sculptor William Story. Pope Pius IX had it sent to London to be exhibited at the World Exposition. It was called the Libyan Sibyl. It was a sensation. It was linked to Sojourner for the rest of her life. Harriet Beecher Stowe, you know who she was, the famous abolitionist and writer, recognized Sojourner as a woman whose efforts accelerated changes, now listen to this, that preserved and remolded our nation. She's included in our studies of Black Africa Month, mainly because she was also a powerful Christian evangelist whose influence is still felt in our church. She was a close friend of James and Ellen White and of their boys. She lived near them in Battle Creek for 25 years. If Ellen White is seen as an improbable candidate for the prophetic role that she filled, one must agree that this illiterate black woman also carried out an astonishing and unlikely mission. One Sunday morning, the 11-year-old slave girl found herself in excruciating pain, drenched in her own blood, lying on a pile of straw in her master's barn. Because she understood only Dutch, and Neely and his wife only English, he had beaten her into unconsciousness. The problem was soon solved by selling her to a kindly innkeeper named Martin Shriver, who understood both English and Dutch. And so he taught her English, but she always spoke with a heavy Dutch accent. 18 months later, now only 13 years old, though she had been an excellent worker, Shriver sold her to a farmer named Dumont. He sold her for $300, which was a stiff price for a female slave of any age. But she was nearly 6 feet tall at that age, very strong, very smart. The 10 slaves on Dumont's farm welcomed her. Dumont was proud of her. He prized her highly, and he boasted to his friends that she could do laundry all night long and still outwork anyone out in the field. She looked upon him as a god. Well, there she fell in love with Robert, a young slave from the farm next door. But her new master selected an older man for her to marry. When she was married to this older man, whom she didn't want to be married to, Dumont told her, he said, if you work hard, I will free you in 11 years. Now, what many people don't realize is that even before the Emancipation Proclamation, there were thousands and thousands of slaves in both North and South of black people who were free, because they had been freed, you see. But they'd have to prove it. Then he said, if you work twice as hard, I'll free you a year early. Well, during that period, she bore 5 children, but she labored prodigiously. There were no more beatings. Well, when 10 years was up, she reminded her master it was time for her to be free. But Dumont reneged on his promise. Another year, Belle. He hated to lose her. Another year. Taking her youngest child, she put some clothes in a pillow slip and set out barefoot for the freedom she had so abundantly earned. A few miles down the road, she came to the home of Isaac and Martha von Wegener. They were Quakers. These kind people opened their home to her, and they offered her employment, not as a slave, but as a paid employee. Well, when Dumont tracked her down, he said, "You must come, Belle, you must come back to me. You belong to me. You have broken your promise." She refused. Years later, she described the confrontation with her old master. "Well, Belle, so you've run away from me." "No, I did not run away. I walked away in plain daylight. And all because you promised me a year of my time. Belle, you must come back with me." "No," she said, "I won't go back with you." "Well, then I shall take your child." Von Wagener offered to pay her old owner $20 for Belle and $5 for the child. He wasn't happy with the deal, but because Von Wagener was such a righteous man and didn't budge, he reluctantly accepted the deal, but he left in a black mood. "Thank you, Master Von Wagener," she cried. "There is but one master, Belle, and he who is your master is my master." The Von Wageners were devout Christians, and they treated Belle and her child as part of their family. One day Von Wagener told her that her son Peter, still lawfully owned by Dumont, had been sold to a plantation owner in Alabama. And he also said, "Belle, you should know something. What was done violated a New York state law that prohibits the selling of slaves back to the South. It's a violation of the law." Belle responded with determination. She says, "I'll have my child back." Speaking of it later, she remembered, "Oh my God, I knowed I'd have him again. I was so sure God would help me get him. Why? I felt so tall within. I felt as if the power of a nation was with me." This was all before the Emancipation Proclamation. With the help of friends, she managed to obtain the requisite $5 to hire a lawyer. They came cheaper in those days. And so there was a hearing, and it was not an easy battle. But she was finally ruled the winner in the trial. And the man again who had sold the boy out of state was responsible to get Peter up from Alabama and back to her. Belle was the first known black woman in America to win a court case. 6-year-old Peter was returned to her. Her respect for the law never diminished. Baby Sophia, now 2 years old, went to live with her 3 sisters. They were still legal property of Dumont. But she patched things up with her relationship with Dumont, and so he allowed her to come and visit her children. She later said that the Von Wageners gave her the happiest, most peaceful time of her life. It was a wonderful time because in the evenings, Von Wagener would read the Bible. He read it all through. From evening to evening. Years earlier, on the night before she had been sold to Neeley. He's the one who beat her up. Her mother had taken her and, pointing to the sky, said, "God lives up there. When you are beaten or afraid, talk to him. He will help you. He'll tell you what to do." As much as she loved the von Wegeners, and she'd taken their name actually, she heard that boys like Peter could in New York live as free men and get an education and work in the city. So she decided to go to take him to New York. She found work. To her, the big city was just overwhelming, as you can imagine. Well, she took housekeeping jobs, sent Peter to a navigation school, paid his tuition. They attended the Mother Zion African Methodist Episcopal Church. One Sunday, two strangers met her as she came out of church. "I'm your sister, Sophia," the woman said. "And this is your brother, Michael." What a reunion they had. Glorious reunion. Now, this Bill was a remarkable woman. She had a job at this time with a family called the Whitings, but she worked as a volunteer in the Magdalene Asylum. It was sometimes called the Kingdom. It was a shelter for homeless women. How could she know that it was operated by cultists who conned the rich for their money, but promoted sexual promiscuity and wife swapping? When a book was published exposing the cult and its deeds, Bell was named as an active participant. Indignant, she sued the author for libel, and she was vindicated, and she won a settlement of $125, which was a lot of money in those days. After some brushes with the law, Peter, now a husky teenager, signed on as a member of the crew of a freighter called Zone of Nantucket. During the next few years, she received several repentant letters from him, but she never saw him again. While in New York, she met a scholarly young man, Frederick Douglass. Anybody hear of him? Yeah, I see a few you have. He was later to be known as a powerful abolitionist orator, swept through the nation. 9 years later, still happily employed by the Whitings, she was in deep prayer one evening when she received a message from God. "Go east," the voice said. "Go east." Next morning, she put a few belongings in a bag, walked down to the ferry, where she paid 25 cents for the crossing, and headed for Massachusetts. When it got dark, she stopped at a Quaker farm and asked for a drink of water. She was an opposing woman over 6 feet tall. "What is your name?" the woman asked. "Sojourner Truth is my name, because from this day I will walk in the light of God's truth." Isn't that wonderful? So that's how she got that name. Slowly she worked her way north and east, stopping to work in homes along the way. One day she came upon a large camp meeting. Approaching the group, she felt strange urgings. She went to the leader and she said, "Could I speak? I want to speak." She'd never spoken in public. This exceedingly black woman, tall and dignified in her black Quaker dress and white shawl, was an uncommon sight. But the local preacher led her on, slowly she ascended the platform. "Well, children," she began in her deep, resonant voice, "I speaks to God, and God speaks to me." And so a long and distinguished career as a public speaker began. Then from her heart, she talked about Jesus. She said, "I was left whipped and bleeding. Jesus was scourged and bled, but he bled for us. And he was nailed to the cross." She says, "I want to tell you how I found Jesus." And she told about the reading of Scripture that she had lived with for years with her first Quaker friends. Then in a powerful, melodious voice, she would sing, "In my trials, Lord, walk with me. In my trials, Lord, walk with me. When my heart is almost breaking, Lord, walk with me." It's a good song. Having heard of William Miller, she had attended his lectures and was profoundly impressed with his message, and she was fascinated by the prophetic charts with all the scary animals. Finding herself one evening in a highly noisy and demonstrative group that tended toward fanaticism, she declared, it was a camp meeting. She said, "The Lord might come, move all through the camp, and go away again, and you'd never know it because of all the noise and commotion you make. Here you are talking about being changed in the twinkling of an eye. If the Lord should come, you'd be changed all right. But he'd change you to nothing, for there's nothing in you." She never minced words. Joining a cooperative community in Northampton, Massachusetts, Sojourner worked for her keep and got acquainted with such abolitionists as Wendell Phillips, Parker Pillsbury, the black orator Frederick Douglass, and Lucy Stone, who was a woman's rights lecturer. She went with them all through the states on lecture tours, promoting freedom for both women and slaves. Now, you will be shocked to know that I recently read in the Atlantic magazine that in the 1857 issue of the Atlantic, there was a feature article entitled, "Should Women Be Taught the Alphabet?" See, them's was different times. Attending a lecture one day by Douglas, who was a member of her team, during which he expressed despair and hopelessness and saying, we'll never be free. Slavery will never be eliminated without something happened, terrible bloodshed. It was a big hall. There were a lot of people there. Sitting in the front row, she broke the depressing silence in a voice that reached every corner of the hall. "Frederick," she said, "is God dead?" The effect was electric. The mood of the audience completely changed. Oliver Johnson, a noted journalist who was in the audience, reported that when Sojourner interjected her solemn question, no bullet ever went to its mark with greater accuracy, piercing the heart of the question. Douglas stood demolished and silent. Writes Johnson, "We were all for a moment brought to a standstill, just as we should have been if someone had thrown a brick through the window." Her question, "Is God dead?" has resounded throughout the world for over 150 years. When you go to Oak Hill Cemetery to see where the whites are buried, right next to the whites, you'll see a grave of Sojourner Truth. And on the gravestone, it says, are the words, "Is God dead?" When the Northampton Cooperative disintegrated, Sojourner, with some Quaker friends, moved to Battle Creek. She settled in a small community called Harmonia, a suburb of Battle Creek. Spiritualism was all the fashion there, and her neighbors indulged in seances and rappings. At one seance, Sojourner, with her ear to the floor, broke the silence. Listening for faint rappings, she cried, "Come out, spirit. Hop up here on the table. Come up here where we can hear you. Make a louder noise." Later, she said, "God is the spirit I talks to." Tiring of the spirit business, she moved into the heart of the village, of the town of Battle Creek, near the Adventist College, where she frequently spoke to the students. She tried to learn to read, but she was dyslexic. She sometimes preached in the Dime Tabernacle. This was after the emancipation, quite a while. It seated thousands of people. It was a big audience. She frequently preached there. And she was the speaker at a Sabbath school convention that was held in Battle Creek. She always talked about Jesus. She talked about him to the patients in the sanitarium. She went around visiting the patients. And then when they'd have their daily services in the parlor, which I conducted for 5 years, 8 services a week, she would tell them how she found Jesus. During the Civil War, she was much on the road, going back a little bit. promoting Christianity, abolition, women's rights. She knew how to handle hecklers. At one meeting, a lawyer protested, came to her, and he stood up and he said, "I'm tired of hearing about women." He said, "I don't need to hear about women. Jesus was a man. What's all this talk about women?" She stood up and she pointed to him. She said, "When Jesus came into the world, how did he come into the world?" she asked him. She says, "God and a woman brought him." She says, "Men had nothing to do with it." She had an uncanny skill for making a point with a minimum of words. She loved to deflate the great orator, Douglas, who at times was carried away with his own eloquence. And when she was there, though she loved him and admired him greatly, she did not hesitate to see that he kept his feet on the ground. We could use her with some of our contemporary politicians, couldn't we? Sojourner felt and expressed a surprising love for those who held slaves. She said, "We ought to be like Jesus, who said, 'Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.'" She said, "I feel sorry for them. How will they ever deal with their guilt?" She had a burning desire to meet Abraham Lincoln. He was president in the White House. This was also before the Emancipation Proclamation. And she went to the White House and they said, "No, the president's very busy. He cannot see you." She says, "You tell him who it is that wishes to see him." So they went and carried the message to him. And he said, "Send her up. Sounds like Sojourner Truth." Shaking hands with him, she said, "I didn't hear about you until you ran for president." He replied, "I heard about you." Handing Lincoln a photograph of herself, she paid her expenses by selling pictures of herself. She said, "Here's my picture. It's white on the back side. I'd like a picture of you that's green on the back side." Lincoln laughed and pulled out a $10 bill and gave it to her. She played the same trick on Grant, but of course she only got a $5 bill for that. Though a very old woman, Sojourner would go and spend time in Washington caring for wounded soldiers. This was just during and after the war. She could pick up a large man as though he were a baby. She overflowed with love and tenderness and comfort. And she was critical of the other health caring staff. She said, "They don't show enough love." She came down on them. She always talked to the sick about Jesus and how she found him, how he died for them. While at the cooperative in New England, she had learned about hydrotherapy. She learned it from a black man named Ruggles. He had become famous for his water cure. This was before the Adventists had a sanitarium in Battle Creek. But she used the principles of hydrotherapy on the wounded. She also labored after the Emancipation Proclamation for slaves that swarmed into the capital of Washington. Going through their barracks, she cried, "Clean, clean, clean." This was before Louis Pasteur announced his germ theory. Dr. Kellogg later said that most doctors, it took them 10 or 20 years to even believe that there were germs. When I would talk about germs to the Africans and the Yakusa tribe, they say, "Wah, wana." They thought I was kidding. They didn't believe it. So finding these slaves, they'd been freed, but they were kept in temporary quarters in Washington, D.C. She scolded them for depending on government for support. She said it degraded them. She urged them to learn to read and seek useful work. She came down on them so hard one day, they all got up and walked out on her. She followed them to their quarters. There was some strong talk. There was no peace. Finally, after some songs and stories, she won their support. Tough love is what it was, but profoundly genuine love. After the war, she dreamed of communities of freed slaves who would come north, start farms in Kansas and other states. She promoted that. She also led groups to the cities in the north where there were plenty of jobs because so many men had died in the Civil War that the industries didn't have workers. In her youth, she had enjoyed dancing and booze. And she smoked a pipe until her Adventist friends in Battle Creek talked her out of it. And then she preached against smoking. She spoke to addicts with authority. She said, "Jesus calls us to come out of this world." Hearing her preach was really a moving experience. Unforgettable. She stood tall and straight in a gray or black dress, their white shawl over her head. She looked almost regal. Her great expressive hands gesturing. Audiences usually were hushed even before she opened her mouth. Harriet Beecher Stowe, you know who she was, who traveled all around Europe, traveled around the world. She said that Sojourner had an imposing presence, a presence unrivaled by anyone she had known. "Little children," she would begin in a low, deep, resonant voice, "I will tell you how I found Jesus." Then in a rich Dutch accent, blending her faith in Jesus with her own experiences and with homely illustrations and metaphors, she would lead her hearers into new dimensions of divine love. Those who knew her knew that she was illiterate, and they were astonished at her knowledge of the Bible. She could quote texts verbatim. She once explained that she had children rather than adults read to her. She didn't want anyone to interpret the Bible for her. She said, "God speaks to me through His Word." Her memory was prodigious. One day at the Adventist College at Battle Creek, she was speaking to the students, and as she was getting up to speak, she heard a rustling of papers. They wanted to take notes. She said, "I take notes up here," tapping her temple. She had a pretty good mastery of English, and she could use it effectively. Or according to the mood or the expectations of her audience, she would resort to picturesque slave talk. As she developed her theme, her voice would grow strong and penetrating. Some described it as a trumpet. Outdoors or in a large hall, she was heard and understood by all. At times, in describing the depth of Christ's love, how he came to be one of us and live with us, we rejected him, we scourged him, we nailed him to the cross, but he came to us, but he was raised from the dead. He's coming again. When he comes again, he'll take us to a better place, and then to the new earth. She had it all straight. And then she would pause, and with a loud voice would ring and reverberate throughout the audience, "Glory, glory, glory." No acting, no sensationalism. Her expressions of faith and love were genuine. She was an authentic apostle of God's truth as we know it. Usually during a sermon, she would sing a familiar gospel song or a hymn of her creation. Her tunes were full and melodious. The deep movings of the Spirit often left whole congregations in tears. Dr. Kellogg, as did others in the Adventist community, considered himself to be a close friend of Sojourner. When she was ill, he gave her the tenderest care. And when she was old, the Battle Creek Sanitarium was the largest healthcare institution in the world. It was known everywhere. Yet he took time to take care of her. In her later years, she suffered chronic leg ulcers. Oh, we had those. That when they would come to me with leg ulcers, I tried everything. We didn't have antibiotics then. You can see how old I am. And so he was treating her in her home one day. He decided to try skin grafts. So he called her two daughters with whom she lived and asked for some snippets of skin. They screamed and left the house. They didn't want to get involved in that. So Dr. Kellogg rolled up his sleeve and he took the requisite skin grafts out of his own arm and he implanted them in her leg where the ulcer had been. She carried a ring of white skin to her death. To her, it was beautiful. It was a band of love. As she grew feeble, her mind seemed to sharpen. When asked about it, she replied, "I think about the big things of God." She had the whole plan of salvation as we have it. On a speaking tour, as an old woman, she stayed several weeks at the Boston Methodist Theological Seminary, where she often spoke to the students. Gilbert Haven, editor of the Boston Methodist Weekly, wrote, He described her as the wisest, wittiest woman I know. Sojourner Truth is wiser and wittier than any man. This is coming from a man, an editor, no less. Well, as we think of her life, who can measure the extent and quality of her impact upon our nation? Who can describe the influence on Seventh-day Adventists and on the Advent movement in its entirety? Who can describe the influence she had on Ellen White and on her boys? Students of history credit her for helping to mold the church's attitudes towards African Americans. They see her as providing inspiration and vision to those who, like my uncle Edson White, labored to educate, enlighten, and redeem former slaves. In the current issue of Adventist World, there's a 4-page article on Uncle Edson. There's a picture of him and Aunt Emma. Picture of the Morning Star, which was quite a ship that had an auditorium, a printing press, office, accommodations for living. He built this. I talked to the man that helped him build it when I was in Battle Creek. He said, this guy Edson was a worker. I said, all the whites are workers. They work awfully hard. And so he told me how he and Edson and another man had built this ship. They floated it down the Mississippi. In those days, if you tried to educate blacks, the white population, there had been a reaction. And they'd tar and feather you, drive you out of town. They'd throw rotten eggs at you or stones. But by having them come aboard his ship, he had his own place. In this issue, you know about Vicksburg, the terrible battle at Vicksburg. That's where he started the first school. Here's a picture of it. First church. I don't know if it's true or not, but Charles Dudley, the black Adventist historian who was a vice president of our church, credits him with starting as many as 50 schools. Where did he get his inspiration? I grew up hearing all my life about Sojourner Truth. So I guess he must have, or he was a neighbor of hers. He knew her. Sojourner continued to sing almost until the day she died. A favorite song of hers was, "We are going home. We have visions bright of that holy land, that world of light, where the long dark night is past and the morning of eternity has come at last, where the weary saints no more shall roam, but dwell in a sunny, peaceful home, where the brow celestial gems shall crown, and waves of bliss are dashing round." She was baptized by Uriah Smith. She never became an official member of our church because she said, I'm going to preach in all the churches, which she did. But she was a Seventh-day Adventist according to her belief and her baptism. In her final illness, Dr. Kellogg, now head of this great, famous, world-famous institution, in spite of his heavy duties at the sanitarium, attended her each day in her home where she chose to be. When she fell asleep in Jesus, she was honored at a memorial service in the Adventist Tabernacle and in the Congregational Presbyterian Church in Battle Creek. As I told you before, she's married in Oak Hill next to our family plot. And there, boldly chiseled on her headstone, are the famous words, "Is God dead?" So until the glorious day when with thunder and lightning the heavens are rolled back as a scroll, and Jesus and the angelic hosts appear in the sky and the trump of God resounds, the graves are opened, and the faithful are gathered together to be with Jesus, her deep and melodious voice will ring and resonate in the hearts of God's people. And I hope it will resonate in your hearts. We are going home. We have visions bright of that holy land, that world of light. Now, our closing hymn is number 281. And while we're getting ready, or you're opening your books, I have to tell you something about Uncle Edson. Uncle Edson, though growing up in a very godly family, had no interest in religion. He was the black sheep of the family. He was extravagant. He was a fancy dresser. But he just didn't have time for the church. James and Ellen White were so concerned about him that they talked about resigning from their positions in the church because of him. But then he heard the message that Sojourner Truth preached about Jesus. How he was scourged. How he was nailed to the cross. How his blood flowed from his pierced side. He gave his heart to Jesus. I have read the letter he wrote to his mom. He said, "I've given my heart to Jesus. I want to do his will." And then he began reading some of the things she had written about doing work for freed slaves. He said, "That's what I want to do." So, with his Morning Star boat and with the many schools, Oakwood College considers him one of its founders. He not only taught people to read and write, he taught them about Jesus. And he was a musician, so he came across a poem that seemed to tell the story in which Jesus is talking to us. And he wrote the tune for it, and you'll find it, and you'll find his name in the hymnal there, page 281. Thank you.